We already had set the stage for a disaster before COVID even showed up. We weren't healthy to start with, and this just pushed us over the edge.
Our guest today is Dr. Austin Perlmutter, and we talk all things inflammation and how it can wreak havoc on our brain and make us more likely to be depressed and even cloud our judgment. Stay tuned. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Blue Blocks. So you know that I've done so many episodes on the topic of sleep because I'm obsessed with it. Sleep is one of those things that you nail it, you get your sleep right, you optimize your sleep, it changes everything. It changes everything. That's why the clinicians at our medical clinic and a lot of my friends that have been on this podcast, sleep is one of the biggest areas that they focus on. I'm always trying to come up with better solutions for sleep. Now, there's a ton of things that you can do that are super low cost, and there's also gadgets that you can include in that can make a difference. Now, the thing about gadgets is that many of the gadgets out there can be pretty inexpensive or inaccessible to a lot of people, but there are some low-tech gadgets, and I want to talk about one of them, and that is affordable blue light blocking glasses. This is a super easy way to block the blue light from screens and from the light that's coming from your room. And what it does is it boosts your body's natural melatonin production. I love the blue light blocking glasses made by Blue Blocks because unlike other mass-produced brands, their glasses are based on peer-reviewed literature and the science of how light impacts health. Blue Blocks glasses have improved my sleep and I've handed a few out to some friends and it's helped their sleep as well too, which means now they have more energy throughout the day. The team at Blue Blocks makes a variety of high-quality blue light glasses to cover different areas of your life. For example, they have clear lenses, blue light line to combat computer screen and artificial light. They have summer glow line to block blue light, but add in a little yellow light for mood-boosting effects. And their sleep line, which also you can wear a few hours before bed, and that blocks 100% of blue and green light for optimum melatonin production, improved sleep. That's what I'm all about. That's the one that I recommend the most to folks. Blue Blocks has more than 40 stylish frame options available in prescription, non-prescription, and readers. And they even, get this, have kids' sizes. Right now, Blue Blocks is offering my listeners 20% off. Just go to blueblocks.com/Drew and use the code Drew. That's D-H-R-U, all one word. So Blue Blocks is blueblocks.com/DHRU with the code Drew, DHRU. I hope you'll check them out so that you can get better quality sleep to give love and attention to all the things you care about in the day. Now, let's get back to this week's episode. Welcome to the Drew Perowit Podcast. Each week, we explore the inner workings of the brain and the body with one of the brightest minds in wellness, medicine, and mindset. This week's guest is Dr. Austin Perlmutter. Dr. Austin Perlmutter is a board-certified internal medicine physician and New York Times bestselling author. He received his medical degree from the University of Miami and completed his internal medicine residency at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon. His focus is on helping people identify and resolve the biological basis for stuckness in the body and the brain, especially around decision-making. He is the host of Get the Stuck Out podcast and is a co-producer of Alzheimer's, the Science of Prevention docuseries. His writings are featured online on many publications, including MindBodyGreen, Kevin MD, Medium, Psychology Today, and DavidPerlmutter.com, who's his father. Dr. Perlmutter is also the author of a recent review paper on the interfaces between immune function, depression, and COVID-19. And that's exactly where we start off today's conversation. Dr. Austin Perlmutter, welcome back to the podcast. It was a pleasure to have you on with your dad when we were promoting your book. You can see in the background, Brainwash. But now it's super exciting to have you on for a solo episode because you have a lot of things to say. So it's a pleasure to have you here.
Yeah, Drew, so exciting to be back with you. And a couple of things have changed in the world since we had our last conversation, and hopefully we'll get into some of that today.
Yeah, I want to actually just jump right in. You know, we have a mutual friend. You had a really great podcast episode with him, and that's Sean Stevenson from the Model Health Show. And anyways, Sean has a great quote, and I thought this was a great place to start because it so embodies the message around this incredible article that you wrote that I think everybody here, if you're interested in brain health and you're looking for what lessons you want to take from the pandemic that we just went through and also to protect yourself going forward, not just from viruses, but your overall health. There's an incredible article that you wrote called "The Coronavirus Took Advantage of Our Weakness." And I'll share this quote with you, and I'd love to get your thoughts on it and extrapolate it and expand on it. And Sean's quote said, chronic disease loaded the gun and coronavirus pulled the trigger. I would love you to run with that and take it in any direction that you want to.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the themes that came out of the COVID literature pretty early on is that people weren't all at the same level of risk for developing complications of COVID. So severe COVID, right? The stuff that gets you into the hospital, gets you into the ICU, and in some cases leads to death. It was pretty consistently shown that people who had comorbidities, chronic diseases, things like heart disease and diabetes and obesity, were at a much higher risk of having a worse time if they contracted COVID. And why that's so interesting is because COVID, or the coronavirus, is an infectious disease, meaning it is coming from a virus, but COVID itself, COVID-19, is the disease caused by this virus. And what we were seeing with this literature and what we've continued to see is that people who had non-infectious diseases, things that weren't transmissible as a bacteria, a virus, a fungus, and instead were things like chronic metabolic diseases, again, the diabetes, the obesity, heart diseases, hypertension, that these were translating into an increased risk of problems if people contracted COVID. So this was really the theme of the article that I wrote, which was to get people to better understand that it wasn't as though what had happened in the last couple of decades didn't matter, that the food that we ate, the exercise we didn't get, the stress we were constantly basically marinating in, that these things appeared to translate into a far worse chance of poor outcomes when a person contracted COVID. So it's getting back to that quote from Sean, it is that we already had set the stage for a disaster before COVID even showed up. And it was really just that extra bump from this virus that has caused so much heartache and destruction. We weren't healthy to start with, and this just pushed us over the edge.
You know, in that article, you actually introduced me to a gentleman's work that I had heard about some of the implications, but I didn't know that actual person. It's a Mr. Omran, and you introduced us to this epidemiological transition theory. And I think that's a great place to just set the foundation of this conversation a little bit. So can you walk us through that a little bit high level and how that relates to the current state of the world that we're in right now?
Yeah. So this gentleman, this epidemiologist, he basically looked at compartmentalizing the different stages of our risk for diseases into these three major stages. So he talks about this pre-modern era. And this is where we dealt with famine, right? This is where you had pestilence. This is where you had these widespread natural disasters that would occur because of seasonal changes. So if we didn't have access to food, tons of people would die. And so people in this period were not really living all that long. We're talking about average age around 30 years old. So very young people dying relative to today's standards. We were also having a lot of deaths in this period due to malnutrition, childbirth issues, infections. And then in the second phase, this was what he called the age of receding pandemics. And so life expectancy in this phase went from around 30 to maybe 40, 50 years old. Infections were still an issue in this period, but we weren't really having as many issues with epidemics. And then in the 20th century, pretty early on in the 20th century, this professor talks about this stage three, where we have degenerative or man-made diseases. And this is really where we find ourselves in the conversation today about all of these problems that result from metabolic dysfunction, really those diseases that I've already described, which are these chronic and largely preventable diseases. Basically, go to any chart of the top killers of Americans, and you're going to see what we're describing here, these chronic preventable diseases. And so why that's so important is I think it provides a larger picture of, you know, maybe where we've been and where we're at now. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't really make the connection between infectious diseases and metabolic diseases. And that is so key, I think, to understanding not just, you know, some of the complications and death rates from COVID, but also in unifying this conversation around what is it we need to be thinking about as it relates to our health, and start to getting to a little bit more of a granular detail as to the fact that these systems we used to think were separate, the immune system, our hormones, our brains or our neurologic systems, they're all interrelated. So this sets the stage again for our understanding of what's happened now. Yes, we were largely in this era where we're dealing with the complications of chronic preventable diseases, but infections come on top of that. They kind of hijack this pre-existing problem. And in so many ways, that's what we've seen here with the people who have been at higher risk for complications from the coronavirus.
You know, there's so many implications with what you're talking about. And I think the biggest thing is, can you learn the lessons of history, right? That classic quote of those that fail to study history are doomed to repeat it. And in a short way, we've just gone through this historical moment that upended the world, that completely decimated a lot of the global economy. And unfortunately, because we have vast disparities in economics between people, we still have the lowest, most disenfranchised group that are still going through economic struggles around the world. So we went through this major upheaval. And while, you know, there's difference of opinions on vaccines, and we've done other conversations around that, and very thankful around all the technologies that create that, we know that if we don't get the bigger story, we might be doomed to repeat what happened in this last viral pandemic. So take us a little bit further from there. Like, if you had the ear of some of the top global leaders, you know, and this is in 2019, and you're talking to them about what might be coming up, and you wanted to protect the world in a better way from what was coming in the future, you know, what would you really tell them about what we needed to do and pay attention to?
So Drew, I think one of my central themes, or I don't think it is, one of the central themes that I've been focused on over the last several years is the importance of moving away from reactivity as a solution to our problems. And it's really, I think, so evident that in the modern world, we are trying to solve these decades-long problems with Band-Aid solutions, a reactive solution. And this happens in healthcare. It happens everywhere. I mean, it's why, you know, we have a terrible job and we come home and then we binge watch Netflix. Like, that is a reactivity piece of decision making. It's why you get into a bad relationship, you have an argument, you eat a pint of ice cream. It's a reactive thing. Whereas in both of those cases, probably need to be thinking about, how is my job? How is my relationship? What can I do to prevent this negative outcome, which is either binge watching TV or eating this unhealthy food time and time again, from happening again? So really, again, what I'm trying to reinforce is we need to work on moving away from reactivity and towards reflection, and trying to understand what are these deeper root causes of our problems. An important point, I think, for all of us to appreciate is, prior to COVID, it's not like people in general were doing all that well. So life expectancy was already falling in the United States for several consecutive years. We look at these, the aging spectrum, and what we see is not that people are aging gracefully, it's that they're developing at least one chronic disease. So average American adult, at least one chronic disease. These are very debilitating. Prior to causing death or contributing to death, we're not a healthy nation. And I'd say when you look at rates of depression, anxiety, you would think that given the fact that we in theory have everything we need to be happy, or at least that's what marketers would want us to believe, that we'd be a happier people. And yet we haven't seen that depression rates have significantly declined over the last several decades. And there's actually good data to suggest that, again, prior to COVID, because it's a little different now, rates of depression and anxiety were going up, especially in young girls, especially in young people as a whole. So we're not a well people prior to any of this happening. And then you have to ask, why is that? And does the reason for people not being well correlate with what we're seeing now post-COVID? And I think it does. I think the reason that we're not well has a lot to do with the fact that we're just taking in all the wrong inputs. we're getting ourselves progressively more and more stuck in destructive patterns of thinking, in destructive biology, and that is leading to these disease states. And so one of the things that really correlates with this stuckness in the brain and in the body is making reactive decisions, making impulsive decisions. Those are the choices that lead to poor choices in food, poor choices in relationships, poor choices in the content that we consume, and subsequently to poor health. That poor health then leads to an increased risk for a variety of diseases, of which COVID appears to be one.
You know, you mentioned depression, and this podcast largely got started, and it was previously called Broken Brain before we changed it to my namesake. And we mostly focused on brain health, mental health, and especially exploring things like depression and other, conditions, symptoms, diseases that people were going through. You recently wrote a paper on the topic of the intersection of COVID-19 and the pandemic and depression. What did you want people to know about the relationship between the pandemic and depression that is especially, again, going back to our first point, is a lesson that we could take with us going into the future?
So I, like you, Drew, have been interested in mental health for, I guess, a long time. I mean, in part because I was trying to figure out my own, where my anxiety and depressive symptoms were coming from. And in part because I think that it's so much at the root of what people are really struggling with. I think that when you look at why people do what they do, it is their mental status that kind of dictates the way we see the world, the lens through which we see the world. And it's really in response to the state of our brains that we do and feel what we do. So I wanted to, in this paper, and it's a review paper, look at the intersection between the COVID pandemic, depression, and the immune system. And the reason I wanted to do this is because there is a lot of data looking at how depression and the immune system are linked. And something I know you're aware of is that inflammation, which we need to appreciate, inflammation is a reflection of an imbalanced immune system. Inflammation is a type of immune dysfunction, but inflammation has consistently been correlated with increased risk for depressive symptoms. So we have this connection here between the immune system and mental health. And now we think about what has happened in the world as a result of COVID-19. So in this paper, I looked at two major aspects of the COVID-19 pandemic. One is what happens when you actually get infected with the coronavirus, a little redundant. And the other is what happens when the policy level measures designed to prevent the viral spread change our immune system. And what was so interesting in doing this review article is it became clear that both the infection itself and the policy changes that led to psychological stress, economic stress, the inability to see other people, that these things converge upon these inflammatory pathways in the brain that have been linked to depression. So while we sometimes think about policy level changes as, having effects on people's economic well-being, on their stress levels, what I don't think we appreciate is that policy changes are immune interventions, and they're immune interventions that change our mood. And the weighing of the pros and cons to these things, or just trying to consider the outcomes that will result from these policy changes, I don't think often understand that, you are still going to see these repercussions as it relates to the things that we traditionally talk about. So when you think about chronic stress, poor diet, lack of exercise, lack of social connections, these things have all been associated with worse health. And those are also things that have been correlated with worse mental health. And those are all outcomes that have resulted from the COVID pandemic type restrictions. So to kind of summarize here, the main takeaway point that I had from this is that, yes, we need to consider how the COVID virus may affect our mental health by way of neuroinflammation, by way of changing our immune system in other ways. But we also need to think about the fact that any sort of intervention that messes with the way people eat, that messes with the way people exercise, that messes with the way people interact with others, is also going to have similar effects on our physiology. And because of the way the immune system works, may also be leading to much higher rates of depression around the world.
You're firmly in this world now. You've written books with your dad, who is one of the figures that, you know, people stand on his shoulders, and many other people's shoulders in that space, like Dr. Jeff Plan, my business partner, Dr. Mark Hyman. And now you're fully in this world. You're writing books. You have your podcast that's out there too. What, you know, you mentioned your own experience with depression and anxiety. Now that you have a better lay of the land and you've gone, you know, you have your medical degree, you became a clinician, you've written on this topic, you're putting fantastic research papers together, review papers together. What do you think was one of the missing links, if any, right? Depression has a lot of different points and inputs that can play into it. And you can have 100 people that feel depression or anxiety, and all of them have different root causes. We know that through the world of personalized interventions. But what do you think you might have been missing as a piece of the puzzle if those are things that you are not sort of struggling with in the same way that you were before?
I think that the biggest breakthrough for me was getting through this kind of damaging myth that the way that you feel is a reflection of you as a person, as opposed to a reflection of your biology. And why that's so key is that I think we largely blame people for things that we feel are a reflection of their person, whether that's a bad decision they made, or even their mood. And when you understand that our biology, the same stuff that influences whether we get heart disease, influences the way that we feel, our mental health, then you can start getting curious about it. And, you know, again, the more variables here, I think, the better, because then you can ask, maybe it relates to the food I eat. Maybe it relates to my gut health. Maybe it relates to the news media I'm consuming. And once you have those variables on the table, in addition perhaps to, you know, more conventional treatment, you can start to look at what I believe is ideal, which is a more holistic approach to asking, first of all, what is depression? It's not just meeting the criteria. There's more to it than that. And to assume that one person's depression, even though it meets the same criteria as another person's, is identical is very unreasonable. One of the things that I saw in my clinical practice is I would have a patient come in who would meet criteria for depression because they had a family member die. And then another person who would come in and meet criteria for depression because they weren't really sure what had happened, but they've always had a relatively low mood. And to assume that the causes are the same, yes, maybe some of the underlying biology is the same, but it's not an identical set of pathology. So in one person's case, it might be due to the fact that they're not producing enough short-chain fatty acids. They have too much inflammation in the body. Maybe they have a deficit in neuroplasticity. In the other person's case, it might be due to the psychological impact of that acute stressor, which was that person's family member or friend dying, which, yes, may act on some of those same pathways. But the point being here is that expanding the idea of what depression is, what it represents, to a broader set of variables allows us to, I believe, both have more empathy for the person because we're no longer blaming it on a personality issue or a self issue, and also look at potential solutions that are perhaps outside the traditional box. One of the additional topics that, you know, I think is relevant here is when you look at how conventional antidepressants work, whether it's SSRIs, TCAs, or otherwise, we're now understanding that these work through a lot of these pathways that I've already described, one of which is immune-related pathways, that these medications can have effects on neuroplasticity, can have effects on inflammation. So again, I think the traditional teaching, and certainly a lot of people have moved past this, is that depression represents a serotonin deficiency in the brain. But based on the literature that I have reviewed, it is clear that there is a lot more going on. And it's clear that not everybody who takes a drug, an SSRI, designed to increase serotonin is going to have a remission of their depression. So once we start looking at what else might be going on, then we can become open to these other potential therapeutics. And I'm interested in everything from psychedelics to nutrition interventions as it relates to targeting those pathways. But the first step is going away from blame and towards curiosity.
And in that process of moving away from blame, which also includes practicing some degree of like self-compassion and really saying like, even when we felt that we weren't, for instance, there's so much literature that's out there about how exercise can be beneficial for people who are experiencing depression. And a lot of times people feel guilty that I am depressed and I'm not exercising. Okay, great. Having some compassion, the fact that you're trying to do the best thing that you can do right now. So how do we do small habits, tiny habits, habit stacking, whatever version of it is to just make little bits of progress and just say, I did the best that I knew how at that time. Sure, I might have feelings that I want to do better, but I'm still, doing the best that I know how. So specifically for you, just only because you mentioned it, and you don't have to go down this topic if it doesn't feel comfortable, since you mentioned you went through your own mental health challenges, and that's a big part of what got you into this space on top of everything that you've learned from your father's work that's out there, were there things that you worked on that significantly moved the needle forward for you in addition to letting go of that blame component?
For sure. One of the things that I talked about in Brainwash is going through residency out here in Oregon. And for those who don't know Oregon, it's a beautiful place, but it also rains and it's dark for a lot of the year, which, we have pretty good data that sunlight is good for mental health and an absence of it is not great. And to add to that, I was in the hospital a lot of every day around very stressful situations. So I think it's fair to say my mental health was not at its all-time high. And one thing I found was really helpful was trying to move away from basically coping with it by watching TV, talking about binge watching Netflix shows. I'm not making that up, right? That comes from my experience. And just kind of getting in my car and going out into the woods without much of an agenda, just putting myself in nature. And it was rainy and it was dark, but pretty consistently I'd get home and just feel more connected to myself, more connected to the environment. And, I know that not everybody has access to these incredible natural environments, but it's something that has been personally very significant in my mental health. It's still something that I try to prioritize. And then the other piece of that is the literature, the medical literature and the scientific literature shows that there is this pretty strong connection between health and nature exposure and even mental health and nature exposure. So I am of the mind that whoever you are, you should be thinking about how you can get a daily dose of vitamin N. Now, whether that's going outside, getting an indoor plant, I mean, if you need to, maybe even considering getting some, photographs of nature, potentially certain types of oils that come from plants. So cedar oil, for example, has been shown to have some medical benefit. But again, I think it's reconnecting as a whole that is the major intervention. And one of the ways of doing that is connecting with nature. I think that there are a number of other ways you can do that. In my personal experience, again, exercise has always been a big one. I always feel better after I exercise. It's an immediate augmentation of my mood. With that said, coming back to what you mentioned, Drew, I wasn't always motivated. I'm still not always motivated to exercise. So I think having a toolkit where you start saying, I'm feeling crummy, what can I do to get myself out of it? And it doesn't necessarily require you to go to a binary exercise, or I therefore have to call this one person who always gets me out of this trap. I think it's great to have a variety of potential tools, one of which I think should be nature. So I think, again, it's still something that I'm practicing. I'm not trying to say that I have achieved mental health zen in any way, but the nature piece, also meditation, making that a consistent part of my day. So I try to do meditation every morning before I start the workflow. And I will say this, I don't think this one is as substantiated as some of the other ones, but morning cup of coffee has for me been a significant benefit in lifting my mood. I mean, there are other effects to that as well, but getting that morning cup of coffee is definitely one of my highlights of my day, even to this point.
It's good to talk about, because just like you said, every person is different. I went through my own, and I grew up in the world of mental health. My dad was a C-suite executive at a group of psychiatric hospitals in Delaware, where we primarily grew up. So I always grew up, and I would even in the summers volunteer at the hospital, help them fix computers, because that was what I was really, you know, good at. And you hear so many stories of how people ended up there, what they're going through. That particular hospital didn't have an integrative slant. We didn't really know much about that prior to our home remedies that we had from growing up as Indian, our Ayurvedic remedies. But even as aware as I was in college, my two biggest things that were big drivers behind my battle with mental health was tribe. I felt like I didn't have a tribe of people that I was surrounded with that saw the world in a way that I saw the world as a place to, like, you know, you can be entrepreneurial, you can create things. I just kind of knew mostly people who were going, nothing wrong with it, but the traditional 9-to-5 route, being kind of a cog in the wheel, even if that was a high paid professional. And I had different ideas. I wanted to build businesses. I was interested in health. I was interested in pursuing different books and conversations. I wasn't interested in complaining a lot or even partying a lot. Although I loved dancing, I just didn't want to drink till oblivion. So not having a tribe was a big part of feeling like I'm alone in the world. And we know that even still, there's modern day hunter-gatherer societies that their form of execution, so to speak, is ostracization, you know, kicking somebody out of the group. And when we are out of a group, when we don't have a tribe, when we don't have a community, our body, our nervous system, our vagal nerve starts to think, whoa, we're out in this scary world by ourselves. And historically, you know, growing up on, you know, in our origins as a human species, no one person could really survive on their own. We needed a tribe that was there. So not having a tribe and not feeling a sense of community really played a role for me. The other one, I really thought I was, you know, doing the right thing by having my vegan diet, but I was a very processed food vegan at the time. And I didn't realize how severely deficient I was in a lot of the healthy omega acids that are there, the omega-3s. And when I finally got introduced into the world of functional medicine and did, you know, a very simple test, the omega quant test, which people can get for like 99 bucks, I saw that actually on a very biochemical level, my brain and my body didn't have some of the things that it needed to do its job well. So one thing was dietary intervention, that very quickly reducing processed foods and starting to include in high quality seafood significantly changed my mood. And then the other one was a sense of tribe and having a feeling of purpose and community and belonging of the biggest questions in life, which is why are we here? I only wanted to add that in because your story and my story, while it may seem different, it's just a reminder for everybody that we all have our own individual personalization, especially when it comes to the root causes of what the drivers are for our own individual mental health.
I love that. I'd just like to comment on that first point. You know, I mentioned when I was in residency that my mental health wasn't always so great. And, you know, whether that was depressive or anxious symptoms, there was an overarching sense that this is just what it is. Like, this is the job, so suck it up. And, you know, we don't have to go through all of this, but people should be aware, if they're considering the medical field, that doctors appeared to have at least as high of rates of depression and anxiety as the general public, probably higher. There's research suggesting doctors have higher rates of suicide than the general public. So there's nothing really protective about going into this field. It is one in which people seem to have worse mental health than the average person. So that's important. And I decided, for a variety of reasons, not to go into clinical practice after residency. I'm doing other things. And in part because of that, my mental health is so much better. And what it tells me is really a reflection of what you just said, which is, if your environment isn't great, you can't expect your mental health to be great. This is such a strange myth we have, which is that the problem lies with the person and not necessarily with the environment itself. And sometimes it's just as simple as changing the environment. And that might mean, you know, putting yourself in a physically, geographically different place. I know so many stories of people who started getting out of Portland in the winter because of their mental health needing to be better, and it worked for them. Other people get sad lamps. There's a lot you can do there. But the other piece that you mentioned is the community piece, because when you feel like the square peg in your group of people, either because they're drinking all the time, they're not paying attention to their health. I mean, I can remember my upbringing my dad, who you know well, and my mom had always advocated for healthy food. So I was the kid in the classroom that was bringing in the organic, you know, rabbit food. I was vegan for many of my early years, and I was mocked from all sides, right? It was Susie's birthday and there was a birthday cake, but oh, Austin can't have that because he's some, you know, crazy vegan organic person. Later on, it would be people mocking me for the lunches I brought into like high school. And I could take it now. It's not a problem. But then there was always that feeling of this is a weird thing. Either I don't fit in or I'm doing things wrong. And I think that doesn't help your mental health. What does, though, is exactly what you've just described, which is finding people who can validate the fact that it's okay to be different and who can not only validate it, but be interested, be engaged with those ideas. And I think that just finding the community of people who are like-minded, entrepreneurial, but also medically driven and also really caring about people's health is in and of itself a lifting of some of that, at least for me, where it's no longer constantly putting myself in a situation where people are questioning everything I do, and at least in some cases are excited about and are interested in some of these ideas that may not be conventional.
Let's explore a little bit more and tease out some of the mechanisms of the link between immune health and really the mental health battle, right? So we talked about inflammation, and really inflammation is one version of stress on the body, and there's different types of stressors that are there. What are some other components that play a part in that link of our immune system and depression and the pathways that happen in the body that are things that either we're lacking or we potentially have too much of? Anything that you can think about to add into that topic?
Yeah. So, I mean, the broader picture here is that immunity is not some localized system that fights off intruders. I think that's the story that most of us understand. Immunity is what enables us to kill bacteria and fight off a virus. And the other really important kind of correlate to that is there's this myth that immunity is either doing a great job or it isn't. And, you know, this is something that I know you and I have kind of talked about through our other work, that you can somehow boost immunity and therefore it's going to, everything will be great as long as it goes from low to high. And the nuance here that is so important for people to understand is that the immune system is integrated into every other part of your body. It is in all of your organs. It interfaces with and drives your brain. It changes your metabolism, just as your metabolism and your brain function changes your immune system. So you can't pull one out. You can't say immunity is good, metabolism is not so good, brain function is great. All of these things are interrelated. So then we talk about how this immune system factors into basically any disease in the body, but specifically let's talk about brain-based conditions. So cognitive issues and mental health issues. There is really fascinating research that has been done over the last couple of decades as it relates to both depression and cognition and the immune system. So let's start with depression. It's been several decades now, but researchers were able to show that people who have depression have an elevation in certain parts of the immune system. And these parts of the immune system were those that correlate with inflammation. So basically, inflammation was linked to higher risk for depression. And then to take that a step further, researchers started to observe this kind of interesting correlation between people who were taking an immune molecule. In this case, it was interferon, which is a treatment that is sometimes used for hepatitis and for certain cancers, and higher rates of depression. So people who were taking this molecule, this therapy, had high rates of depressive symptoms. So they said there seems to be something there. And then there's other research where they gave volunteers endotoxin. That is a kind of technical word for a piece of a bacteria. But basically, they injected people with a piece of a bacteria that causes inflammation. And they found that those people started to get depressive symptoms. So all of this started to come together with the idea that depression has this correlation with inflammation, that when you cause people to experience inflammation, it causes them to experience depressive symptoms. So there appears to be, at least at a preliminary kind of view there, this connection between inflammation causing depression. Now, obviously, cause is a very strong word, but it's saying that the literature is hinting at this, right? So now we have in the modern day, I mean, in the last couple of years, we've had lots of large-scale analyses that show that people with depression have an increased level of all of these inflammatory markers. So basically, imbalance in immune system seems to predispose to depression. Because if you look at people's inflammatory markers and then track those people for several years, those who had higher levels of inflammatory markers have higher rates of developing depression. So I'll continue on here for just a moment with the cognitive health, because I think that's fascinating. And then what is most relevant to all of this isn't just that this is interesting, it's that this then represents something we can do something about. We have strategies to lower inflammation in our bodies and our brains. So that's where it becomes actionable. So then the other piece here was the cognition and inflammation connection. We've known for a while that conditions like Alzheimer's are linked to higher rates of inflammation, in that people who have Alzheimer's have higher rates of inflammation in their bloodstream. People who have higher levels of inflammation in their bloodstream have higher rates of developing Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease develops over decades sometimes. So we're talking about inflammation today, you know, maybe not a huge deal if it's slightly elevated, but if you have it sustained, elevated over decades, that might increase your risk for Alzheimer's disease. But now we've seen, only in the last couple of years, that inflammation in your bloodstream today, in this moment, seems to bias your thinking towards making worse choices. So if you created, if I basically made you have more inflammation in your bloodstream right now, you would, based on this research, make worse decisions immediately after that. So this is fundamentally important, because it means that our immune system is on a moment-to-moment basis changing the way that we perceive the world and the way that we make choices. So if your immune system is in a good balance spot, you're more likely to make balance reflective decisions. You're more likely to choose the healthy food option. You're less likely to yell at your spouse. You're less likely to invest in Dogecoin. Had to say it, right? But here you have basically where most people are at today, which is we have very elevated, well, I should say, we have chronic elevation, mild elevation in inflammation as a result of poor food choices, of not exercising enough, of not getting good sleep, of the stress that comes in through watching news. You know, I think watching cable news is one of the worst things you can do for your inflammatory status. And that means that you are not only increasing your risk for making bad decisions, but you're also increasing your risk for developing depression. You're also increasing your risk for all of these conditions that, you know, you've had so many guests talk about, the heart disease, certain types of cancers, diabetes. So what that means to me is that we have a chance right now to get away from this model in which we're going to react so that when you get depression, when you start developing cognitive decline, then we talk about what to do differently, and instead educate people on the fact that they can influence every aspect of their health right now through their immune system, through the lowering of inflammation, if they're, you know, able to start making any number of changes. And those can be, again, dietary, they can be stress reduction, they can be exercise related, they can be even just looking at the quality of your relationships. But it is a portal to anything a person might want. Right? If you want to make more money, you need to make better choices. If you want better relationships, you need to make better choices. If you want good health, you need to make better choices. And certainly having better mental health helps as well. So it's, again, immunity is a portal to better health once you start to understand how it explains a lot of these conditions that we're seeing today.
Yeah. And one way the entire world was talking about immunity, because we just went through this pandemic, but a lot of it was to avoid a very narrow, highly spreadable, but a very narrow virus. And the conversation's primarily been around this specific strain of coronaviruses, of which COVID-19 is one of them. And important, great. And I think that a lot of people that started for the first time, maybe really paying attention, because in the early days, no matter how much knowledge you had, a lot of people were pretty scared about everything because they didn't know how bad everything was going to be with COVID-19. I was one of those individuals that was, you know, pretty worried about it in terms of, whoa, this seems different. And, you know, now there's all these debates and the Biden administration has talked about doubling down on sort of investing into the origins of it. And maybe something will come of that in the future that we can learn about, but people were pretty scared. But I think a lot of those people that for the first time finally had a wake up call of like, whoa, I need to be thinking about this. I need to prioritize sleep. I need to minimize my alcohol. Maybe I should clean up my diet a little bit. Saw unequivocally, so many of our listeners saw that are newer to the podcast, saw improvements in their mood in terms of their metabolic markers that were there. One thing that you improve, and especially here focusing on the immune system, improves all aspect of our health, especially our mental health, which was already on the rise, as you mentioned, before the pandemic came in. So now that we understand, you know, that our immune system is so much bigger than just, you know, avoiding this virus or the next virus that might come and come into the world. What are some of the things that you feel, you know, we've talked about getting in nature, right? We've talked about getting in nature. What are some of the things that you have seen and interventions that you talk about? We talked about community on my end. We talked about getting in nature. If you would prioritize a list, because people are busy and they're thinking about what deserves the biggest, you know, investment, how do you rank out the different pillars in life in terms of approaching and turning around our immune system if it's not fully firing at the level that we want it to?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing I would say is when we're considering a healthy immune system, that I just want to reiterate, a healthy immune system is not just one that fends off pathogens. It's not just the one that can take down a bacterium or fend off a virus. A healthy immune system is also one that is able to find and destroy cancer cells. It's also one that is able to target cells for destruction when they stop working very well and to recycle components of those cells that can be used better. So a healthy immune system, I think, is one that is resilient against a variety of threats, both external and internal. It's one that is flexible. It can alter itself to kind of conform to whatever comes up. So as it relates to that, I think people should understand their goal is not to get an immune system that's on super high defensive mode. What would that look like? A super defensive immune system may be able to take out a bacterial infection when you get it, but it may also go over the top and it may react against, you know, like some pollen and say, I need to go at 110% against this pollen, leading to terrible allergies. Or it might say, yes, I'm going to be incredibly reactive, but I'm also going to react to self cells. So that would basically be autoimmunity. It would start attacking its own cells. The idea, again, is you want a balanced immune system that is resilient against a variety of threats. Where I see the most bang for my buck and what I think is a reasonable place for most people to start isn't just looking at the potency of an individual intervention as far as how much it does. So obviously drugs are the most potent interventions as far as how quickly you're going to see an effect. If you give somebody an injection of, you know, a certain drug in the hospital, in the ICU, let's say, you see changes in their physiology immediately. When you're talking about something like food, unless you have anaphylactic shock, you're probably not going to experience anything quite that rapid. So again, it's not just about the potency. I think it's more about what is going to give somebody the feeling of this was effective. It wasn't an incredible amount of time and money spent to make this happen. Because if I prescribed you a diet that was all organic, had to be pasture fed beef, all of these other things, maybe that would work, but that might be cost prohibitive for most people. And it might just take up most of their time to get that food. So where I go first is sleep. The reason for that is simple. I think getting good sleep sets the stage for everything else to be easier. And researchers have shown that getting one night of good sleep can be the difference between making good decisions the next day or bad decisions the next day. Those decisions, again, those are going to have an effect on every aspect of what happens next. So I think as it relates to anything health related, I really try to get the brain situated first such that it will then have those ripple effects. And immunity is no different. So it's not just the fact that brain health and immune health are correlated with the quality of our sleep, but that getting that first night of good sleep is going to reset your body such that you're not going to only make better choices, but I think also you'll experience the day better. I think most people subjectively will say they feel better after getting a full night's sleep versus being sleep deprived. So that's one. The next things, you know, I think here are a little bit more open to debate. I mean, I think certainly food is key. I think exercise is key. I think stress reduction techniques as a whole are key. And I think you can go kind of down the road with everything else after that. The one that I go to for most people is try to get this pretty big bang for your buck, which is cutting out the unnecessary stress. Why is that? I mean, you already kind of alluded to this, but there is a very strong connection between stress and immune dysfunction in that too much stress, especially chronic stress, correlates with not only worse immune function, but also elevation in inflammation. So what I think people need to understand is that all of the inputs coming into your body are going to have an effect on the immune system. And we don't think about what comes in through our eyes and ears as significant as what we put into our mouths. We're always talking about the quality of our food and affecting our physiology. We don't always talk about what comes in through our eyes and our ears as influencing our physiology, as influencing our immune system. If you, like most Americans, are spending 11 hours of your day in front of one type of a screen or another, you should be aware that the content you're consuming is most likely designed to be stressful. Why does that matter? That stress is activating your immune system in an unhealthy way. So if you're watching cable news, if you're listening to the radio, if you're on social media, if you are paying attention to the sensationalized, stressful content, I think that is just as important as what you put into your mouth as it relates to the way that you are shaping your immune system. So what I tell people is, number one, take inventory, be aware of what you're taking in. And then two, try see what happens if you cut back on that digital media consumption. See how you feel. You'll feel probably, based on what most people feel, a little bit better, but more importantly, that's an indicator that you are doing a better job programming your immune system for success. So just to emphasize here in order, the first thing I tell most people to do is work on your sleep. The second thing I would tell most people to do is pay attention to the digital consumption coming in. I think food is absolutely essential, but I think that it takes a little bit more time for people to start realizing the benefits, and there's more nuance to it. So I think that the two things that maybe make more sense for the average person would be going for sleep and then digital consumption first.
There's this quote from a past podcast guest who's also been a friend of mine for a long time, and that's Reverend Michael Beckwith. And he says, we have to understand that the news is most often, not always, but most often, simply a reflection of the lowest common denominator of the human experience. And when we get that, you have to ask yourself, do you want to be reminded every day? Often people watch it in the morning and the evening. Do you want to be reminded of the worst of humanity? And if you want to be reminded and you want to be told of what's wrong in the world, even I think there was a comedian, it might have even been Dave Chappelle. I don't know if it was him or for somebody else. They were like, they should just change the name of the news to call it What's Wrong. And you'll turn on the TV and they're like, hey, here's what's wrong today, right? And they're picking something that's out there that's wrong. Now, on a practical level, right, you're somebody that considers yourself very aware of kind of the current themes in the world and sort of important stories when it comes to accessibility, social justice, other things like that. You know, you're aware of kind of the surroundings and you have a knowledge of politics and what's going on. So on a practical level, people always ask, okay, so I want to know, how do you navigate that to stay informed? And what are some actual formats or styles of either listening or reading that you find is a way to keep the information layer and the understanding layer to help you build wisdom on a particular topic, but not the reactionary layer of here's what's wrong in the world today?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think most news is junk food, to put it bluntly. And it'd be like saying, oh, well, people have to eat, so therefore you should be watching the news, right? You have to be informed. That's the narrative that I hear so often. But I do think there are ways that are far more practical and that lead to more efficacious conversations. One of the things that I see majorly lacking right now is the ability to engage in conversations with people who have disparate opinions. So if you are a Republican, it's hard to talk to Democrats. If you share one kind of social idea, it's challenging to reach out to people who have others. And if you only pay attention to the news channel that promotes those ideas, you get this idea that everyone in the world is in line with your opinion. So one of the things that I actually do is occasionally I will tune into news stations, newspapers, whatever, for ideas that are completely opposite from mine. And I do my absolute best. It's an exercise to just try to look at it objectively. So I try to get exposure to those other ideas. I try to engage in conversations with people who I know have different ideas than I do. It is an exercise. But unless we understand that most people don't have the exact same opinions we do, and if you're in America and you belong to a political party, about half of the people in the country will belong to the other political party. And therefore, you know, you're either in a situation where you're writing off half of the population as having absolutely no idea of what's going on, or you put yourself in a place where you're saying, there are things that I don't yet understand that I may be wrong about. So that's part one, is just to come into these conversations with the expectation that I don't have all the answers, that I'm guaranteed to be incorrect about things, and try to learn from the information. But then it's the question of what information am I learning from? Because this could easily get me down a path where I'm spending hours a day watching the news. What I try to do is spend about 10 minutes every morning. I have a specific news website or newspaper that I will read to try to get a general sense as to what's been happening in the world. But then I try to then turn to places where this information has both been digested a little bit more by people who are a bit more neutral, and that might be listening to podcasts. And then it's trying to go to sources that I feel are a little bit more more balanced. And what that means for me is trying to get the scientific articles that show me what's actually happening as it relates to some of these themes. I find that not always, but often, the scientific literature requires a little bit more objectivity. And so therefore, if I want to learn about what is happening as it relates to differential effects of the coronavirus on races, right? So I might go to a paper there as opposed to reading either the newspaper article or listening to the news story that is blaring at me that this is known, this is established. So I try to look a little bit more at the statistics, at the data, and then ideally not take it just like I do with nutrition based on one study and instead look at what literature is out there. If I'm really interested in a subject or if I think that I don't know it very well and that's a problem, I'll just try to find a book or two that are written in, again, a tone of somebody who actually knows what they're doing because they've spent some time in that space and who have somewhat of a track record. But the last thing I'll say on this, because I think it is a really important topic, is it really comes down to conversations with people around these things, thoughtful conversations, curious conversations, and then the difference between reacting and acting. I think that there is a conflation between paying attention to the news and actually doing something about it. And I know people who will, you know, send out the most intense stories from the news every day via email chains, and or they'll talk about how terrible things are in another part of the world. And it seems like the conversation itself is the stand-in for actually doing anything about it. And I feel that in all of these cases, it just has to be a question of like, what are the priorities we have? If the priority is just discussing bad things happening in the world, fine. But if the priority is actually improving quality of life for both myself and other people, I think there are so many better ways of going about that. One of the ways is having conversations that are geared towards solutions to say, what does this now mean as far as how I will change my actions? As opposed to what most of these conversations tend to be, which is spinning our wheels, in essence, rehashing the same horrible things for the benefit of having something to talk about.
It reminds me of a quote. I believe the gentleman's name was Gregory McCown. He was on my friend Dr. Rangan Chatterjee's podcast recently, and his quote was, if you don't prioritize your life, someone else will. And I think when it comes to priorities, we have to also remember that our priorities for ourselves, which might be, you know, growth, wisdom, connection, love, betterment, you know, all the things that we want to do, you might have, or you might be getting news from a source. And this often by extension, social media has kind of turned into a news. It's the latest news. It's the latest negativity aspect that's there. So I also don't want to, there's many beautiful things about social media, just like there are some news sources that try not to be so sensationalist in one direction or another. But the priority of whatever information dump you're getting, if it is somebody using any form of sensationalism, which also happens in wellness, right? We all know people who their primary category in wellness is, what is the most sensational thing that I could put out today? Because that gets more interaction, gets more shares, there's more growth on social media. So we have to remember that really the process of checking in with what our priorities are, and it's not a one-time thing, it's a regular thing. That's the power of my fiance and I do something when we wake up in the morning. We say just a simple, what's our intention for the day? Before we pick up the phone, before we go off onto something else, like, what's my intention for the day? What do I want for myself? What's my prioritization before anybody else comes in with their priorities of who they want me to demonize, who they want me to, you know, believe into a particular victim narrative, a victim narrative, or who they want me to be against, or what tribalism is trying to take over today. I want to set my priority before anybody else gets in the mix and tries to take me down the direction of one way or another, which is really a form of manipulation. And we want to be anti-fragile in that way. We want to be not easily manipulated, and we want to have our bearing. And that comes from us prioritizing ourselves. And if we don't, somebody else will give us their priorities of what we have to follow.
Totally agree. I think there are so many correlates to what you're saying. A really great example is just busyness, where we, in theory, come into life with this idea that we're optimizing for happiness. And then at some point that gets replaced with these surrogates. And a great example of where that's happening right now is busyness. It's, well, I didn't set my intention for the day, but I was busy the whole time. I mean, I actually said this to my girlfriend. I said, you know, tomorrow's a busy day. And she said, are you saying that as a good thing or as a bad thing, or just to let me know? And I think that this is so key to it, because the day can be both filled up with things that are of no real benefit to us, but sound good, right? Your schedule is full. You have all of these things that you're, quote, doing. But to your point, you know, it's all about programming, and that has kind of a negative connotation, and maybe it should, but you are being programmed every day, and you can kind of direct that programming in that you're looking at how the food that you're putting into your body is going to change your microbiome, is going to benefit your brain, and therefore program you for better health. Or you can allow that programming to be directed by whatever comes on the TV or whatever conversations you wander into on social media. And I think that, again, one of these myths we have is that we are somehow able to maintain who we are as a person independent of anything we're taking in, right? So the Drew today is the same Drew as yesterday, and that's not going to be changed by the environment. But we know that our bodies are changing over, right? That all of our cells are being replaced, that our brains are changing their wiring, their connections. And so unless we are aware of this, unless we're aware of the quality of the programming that's coming in and directing that process, we are liable to, or odds are, we're going to wind up, like most people today, making bad decisions, unhappy with the quality of our lives, and unhealthy. So I think what you're describing, what you're doing in this process of trying to set intention, I mean, there was a point, I think, where everyone tried to set an intention, whether that was with a high school guidance counselor or when they sat down with their parents and they said, you know, you should be a lawyer, or you should get married, and you should have a couple of kids. That was the intention that was set. And what we forget is to question that again and to say, is that actually what I want? Is this actually the trajectory that I want? Because what I feel happens is that in theory, everyone's objective, I would argue, is to live a fulfilled, happy, content type life as much of the time as possible. That doesn't mean not going through tough times. What that does mean is if you're looking at the area under the curve, you want as much area there as possible. And so that means there's going to be some dips, but you also want to offset that with the peaks. So again, you want the best life possible, and you think about contentedness, you think about being happy, you think about strong relationships and the like. And then what happens is somebody or people will tell you that's not specific enough. You need to focus on academics, focus on becoming this. In my case, focus on becoming a doctor. And the problem is, I think we often wind up several decades into our lives feeling like something is off, right? You're either doing the thing or you're not doing the thing, but you're not experiencing life the way you thought you should, which is, I'm not happy. I'm not healthy. What is going wrong? And it's exactly what you said. It's that we are not reflecting on our intentions. We're not setting our priorities. We're allowing them to be driven by prevailing winds, right? We're basically being buffeted around in a sailboat. And we're probably going to wind up on some island that's thousands of miles away from the island of happiness that in theory we were setting out to. So I think it's the course correction that is essential. And I think that it's not a popular thing to sit down and evaluate whether the direction we're heading is actually in sync with what we really care about. And it's tough too, because a lot of the times we create these kind of structures that make it hard for us to see or to at least appreciate that what we're doing is not in alignment with where we're trying to go, whether that's a job or relationship or otherwise. But again, I think that's part of this theme that I described, which is kind of stuckness and where we get stuck in certain patterns of action that may not actually be in any way advantageous to us, but we continue to do them because it's what we know. It's what we're reinforced to do. It's what we see on TV, so it makes sense. It's what we see on social media, so we might as well continue this. And forget that most people are not doing very well. The average person is not doing well. Unless we do something that is objectively different from what the average person is doing, we can't expect to do better than the average person, which again is not doing very well at all.
I love what you said, because it really is talking about a shift in perspective. And that goes back to the core aspect of the default neural network that we all have, and how we get good at skiing down the same slope again and again and again. So we have ridges that we create, which means that when we're skiing down that slope, if we imagine a neuron, when we try to lift our skis out of that ridge that we've created, that path, it can be a little bit tougher if we don't push ourselves a little bit. You know, we got to push ourselves a little bit to think outside of our perspective. Because you've been interested in brain health for a while and you're very open-minded, how, whether it's a personal level, if you feel like, you know, chiming in on that, or just from a research level or observing it, how have you thought about, or how do you think about plant medicines when it comes to this idea of potentially giving us a perspective that is different than what we have and opening up the default neural network? So just curious about that.
Yeah. This is obviously a popular subject, and it's something that for good reason should continue to be a popular subject. So variably discussed as psychedelics, as individual compounds or molecules, or plant medicine, the idea that there are these exogenous substances, in some cases natural, in other cases synthetic, that can significantly alter our states of consciousness and have been increasingly correlated with improvement in mental health outcomes. The one that I think I'm most interested in right now is psilocybin. And the reason for that is many things. One is kind of some of the studies that have been done looking at depression, but also that it's correlated with changes in people's personality, right? So they did a study where they looked at how people's personalities changed and looks at, you know, kind of the big five traits. And they showed that there were significant changes in personality after using psilocybin in this study. So that tells me that even our personality programming can be changed by this molecule, that this plant-derived, or I should say fungus-derived molecule, is capable of changing who we are as people to some extent. So that's kind of part of it. And then the other piece that's so interesting to me about psilocybin and other psychedelic medicines is that they appear to perhaps be the most potent intervention as it relates to getting a brain unstuck. And so you mentioned, you know, the default mode network. There's evidence that psychedelics might work through changing neurogenesis, neuroplasticity, through changing the immune system of the brain. So we don't have to go too technical into this, but traditional psychedelics like psilocybin act on the serotonin 2A receptor. That is also this receptor, or similar receptors are also found on our immune cells. So it's not like it's just an isolated brain event. It changes the body. So there's really the really fascinating science and the studies that are conducted by MAPS and other institutions looking at how either psilocybin, MDMA, and other compounds or molecules can alter mental health for the better, they're still relatively small studies, but they're increasing as far as how many are being published and the public conversation around them. But I think that's all the science piece. And something that, you know, I haven't really discussed in public forum as much is just I have had personal experience with this plant medicine. And, you know, I am a doctor. I am not in any way telling people that this is something they should go out and seek to do. But I am saying from a personal level that it was one of the most meaningful experiences in my life. And I think that neglecting to at least be able to have that conversation is a problem. Because, you know, the idea that people should experience life in a certain way and that their thoughts should be a certain way is, I think, incredibly problematic. And I think one of the major fears that has kind of stymied the use of and the discovery of the uses of these molecules for a long time is that they do alter our thoughts and that somehow that is a negative thing. But when you look at, you know, large scale studies on whether people have more psychiatric issues when they use these molecules, it's actually the opposite that is true. When you look at the safety profile of these molecules, psychedelics like psilocybin and MDMA, you see that the stories around them being incredibly toxic and causing all these problems seem to be either fabricated or incredibly overblown. So I think when you look at the safety profile of these molecules and the potential benefits that they have, and then you contrast that with what is the safety profile of existing in the modern world with a stuck brain, I think we have to be talking about it. Because this is so fundamental. You know, I'm all for weighing the pros and cons of any intervention, but no intervention is still terrible. If you have no intervention and you spend your decades in America, or, you know, America is actually great in so many ways, but you spend your decades living in America, you are probably going to wind up in a bad place. Again, chronic diseases, high rates of anxiety, depression. So no intervention is still an intervention. And I think we have to be considering the research around these types of molecules. I'm not trying to say we should legalize and make them widespread, but I am trying to say that we can't shut down the conversation because it's scary to certain people. We have to at least be willing to consider the fact that, you know, people should change their minds. People should be able to change their brain function, change the way that they think about the world in such a way that makes them happier people. And to limit access because we're just scared of the possibilities that people's thoughts could be changed makes very little sense to me. So definitely, you know, I have a lot more I could say on this thing. It's something that I feel a lot more than some of the scientific pieces that I often talk about. And I think that there is this fabricated fear around changing your mind, whether it's because of a conversation you have or because of a molecule you consume. But the mind is always changing. It's kind of an intrinsic property of the way that the brain works. And if we don't do anything, that change is going to be based on whatever programming we get. So why these molecules are interesting to me is it gives people the opportunity to change their minds in a way that is beneficial to them. And the enduring benefits have been seen now for years after some of these trials. So yeah, that's where I'm at.
That's a great summary. We had Dr. Roland Griffiths from Johns Hopkins, yep, on the podcast a couple years ago. I interviewed him when he was at the IFM conference, and he got a nice overview of some of that research that you were talking about with depression, smoking cessation. So, you know, people can check out that interview as well. On a very practical level, when people come to you and say, hey, listen, I've been following some of this literature, or I maybe read Michael Pollan's book, or I heard a podcast, and I feel like I want to explore it. But in, you know, one of the advantages of the fact that so many more people are researching it is the hope that if we can make it available in a clinical setting or a supervised setting, and not typically how a lot of people maybe might have experienced it, could be a party setting, or, you know, maybe not even really sure of like the source, if we're talking about psilocybin, if everything's, you know, like clean and that sort of stuff. If people come to you and say, this is something that I'm thinking about exploring, and obviously in the US, we're still in the legalities that we're in, do you have any centers across the world that you've come across that seem to be places where people could go to want to, you know, go down the process in more of a clinical setting. Just wondering on a practical level, if you've come across anything that you'd recommend for people.
Yeah, I think it's a really tough question because, as you know, in the United States right now, it's not legal. There are certain instances in which it's been decriminalized, and certainly there's more research, and there are, at least at the time of this conversation, several agencies that are working to certify providers such that as it becomes more legal, it's something that more people can use. So most people wind up going to other countries, Jamaica and the like, because obviously the laws are different depending on the country. And so there are ceremonies and the like that are done there. You know, again, there are many people with more experience talking about this. So I don't want to distract from people going to find those sources. And obviously Roland Griffiths and others who are doing the research around this are good sources. But I look at what has been done with ketamine, which has obviously, you know, been a tool in depression, and has been rolled out in clinics, and how the efficacy seems to be better when there's more of an integration piece as opposed to just coming in, getting your ketamine and being sent along with your life. And I think that, you know, as it relates to this as well, there may be a tendency for people to just say, oh, I just need a dose of this and I'll get some and then I'll get all the effects that they've done in this clinical research. And it just does really seem to be the case that the integration piece is key. And there are psychiatrists and people in the United States that have actually focused on helping people to reintegrate. That's legal because they're not actually the ones prescribing or going through those the treatment piece of that. But, you know, I can't say that I'm confident to say, if you are interested in this, here is a center in this place or another. There are a couple of groups that I've been in conversations with. There's one called Nova Mind, NovaMind, and I've spoken to their medical team as well as some of their other leadership. And so they're actually building out programs for international retreats around some of this. So I guess if people are generally interested, they have therapeutic centers in the United States right now, not for ketamine and for traditionals, antidepressants, but they are in the process of building out these clinics. And having spoken to their medical director, he was one of the leads and is still doing research on ketamine research currently. So I think that's a good website to check out, but I think this is still really in its infancy. And what I would be concerned about is that there are opportunists who are basically just saying, you can come here, take this drug and go on your way. And that we lose sight of, you know, the fact that this obviously had is in a renaissance, but had for a variety of reasons, many of its channels shut down in the last several decades. So, and I think just for an individual, I mean, I think Tim Ferriss had the quote as far as saying, it's like choosing a neurosurgeon when you're trying to find somebody to guide you through one of these therapeutic sessions. You wouldn't just pick a random neurosurgeon to take out a brain tumor, and you shouldn't just pick a random person to provide you with or to guide you through one of these sessions. So I wish I had a better answer. I wish I had a cleaner answer, but I think for right now it's, those don't quite exist.
Yeah. Well, we'll link to some of those resources. We also have a couple resources that are out there that might be able to help people.
Great.
Navigate. There is an underground group of people that are out there, but obviously for obvious reasons and the legalities being them, you know, they don't want their names being put out there, but there are some groups that are pointing people in the right direction. Let's come back full circle to where the conversation got started. And we were talking about, you know, those who don't study history are deemed to repeat it. When you think, you know, I talked earlier about there, it's actually really interesting to see that if you had questions as an individual about the origins of COVID-19 because of, let's say, the spread rate or other stuff, and maybe you had questions about the original story about it coming from wet markets and other stuff, it was considered very taboo. Let's just say that, right? Maybe a little bit even conspiracy theorist. Now, I think even a lot of very well-respected individuals are saying it is worthwhile to look into it a little bit from a standpoint of whether something was engineered or influenced, or if it was purely the original narrative of coming out of a wet market, maybe potentially, you know, from China. We need to be better prepared so that we can be more resilient as a society. And I even feel like you're taking it another step up. And while there may be interest in discovering what the real origin was, maybe we might find out, maybe we won't find out. There has to be this thing that on a personal level, we have to learn the lesson from what we went through. So let's summarize that lesson, because again, that was really the point of the article that you were bringing up, is summarize the lessons and the takeaways that if we're really trying to make something mean, if we're trying to take meaning away from what we've all been through with the pandemic, we have to integrate it into our lives currently. And that's not just about avoiding the next pandemic. There's larger themes that are there. So if you could summarize, that would be fantastic.
Sure. Well, first let me say, you know, I think it is always helpful to have a better understanding of things. It's just a question of finite amount of resources, and you can't understand everything better at the same time, right? And so I appreciate how narratives around COVID were such that we said we can't be focused on that right now. There are other bigger fish to fry. But on a more lighthearted note, I don't want the pangolin to be implicated in anything that it isn't actually responsible for. So that was, I don't know if you remember early on, it was concerned that this cute little animal called the pangolin was responsible.
Right.
But I think the bottom line to all of this is that we are living out the consequences of yesterday's decisions. And that relates to basically everything that happens. Yes, there are these novel, unprecedented events. But when you look at what people do, it's largely as a reflection of what they did yesterday. And we are, by and large, existing and believing that we make choices in the moment. That the only thing that matters to you, Drew, when you make a choice is how you feel about the decisions in front of you right now, in this moment. It's, let's say you're at a restaurant, there are two options on the menu, one's healthy, one's unhealthy. The only variable there that really matters is what you care about, what you want to do right then. And I mean, you could say like, that's willpower. And the truth of it is that our brains yesterday, a week ago, a month ago, a year ago, generations ago, have had these programs written in. And it's largely these unconscious programs that drive our decision-making, that influence our health. And so when you look at this instance, which is you have a pandemic of a very transmissible disease that causes a lot of death and destruction, you could say that what happens as a result of this is the result of basically this brand new thing that happened. Or you could start to use the model I just described, which is looking at what has happened over the last decades, generations, and ask how that has predisposed us to not just COVID, let's just take that off the table, but any new threat that comes up to our health. And are we ready for those things? And I think for a variety of reasons, no, we were not ready for COVID. Our health infrastructure was not in a good spot for it. In the United States, great example of that. I mean, I don't want to tread into political places here, but I think it's pretty clear that things could have gone better in the United States for a variety of reasons, right? But also the baseline health status of people wasn't good before COVID, and that certainly didn't help anything. And I have to say, you know, this conversation about pre-existing metabolic disease, diabetes, heart disease, whatever, as being a risk factor for COVID was at one point seen as an important and somewhat novel fact. But if you talk to anybody who has worked in an ICU, you will know that the people who come in with comorbidities are always at higher risk of having bad things happen. They're comorbidities. They increase risk for worse outcomes because it means their health wasn't in a good place to start with. And I think that to understand that we're not a healthy people to begin with, and therefore any little, you know, extra Jenga piece that gets pulled out, whether that's COVID or something else, is going to be a problem. It pushes us over the edge. That's fundamental. But I think the advocacy that I really have here is to understand that our health conditions today are a reflection of our decision-making yesterday. They're a reflection of our decision-making for the last several decades. And this really ties into, I think, one of these core themes that we've been discussing, which is the quality of the programming of our brains, the quality of our immune system, the quality of our systems in our body that enable us to either move through the world in an intentional way where we're making good choices, or kind of put us in a path where we're always reacting to whatever is in front of us, where we're always reacting to the stressors, where we're always reacting by eating unhealthy foods, where we're being led into marketing traps. So you can talk about the large scale political changes that would be good for America. And I know that you have had people on your show and that you've been in discussions where we talk about the fact that processed food is a disaster, that too much sugar is good for no one, that we really need to be thinking about, if we're going to eat animals, eating those that have been either farmed or caught wild, but that are high quality for us. I think all of that is important. And I think that, you know, obviously Mark Hyman has done an amazing amount of work here and it's essential. But what we have to understand is we're only able to make those decisions if our brain is on board. And if you're letting other people write the code in your brain that is dictating your decisions, it's going to be bad choices. And we will feel responsible for it, even though it was programmed in by other people. So where I start with all of this is to be aware that your choices, that your health is only as good as the quality of your brain. It's only as good as the quality of that wiring, of those connections, the activation patterns. And that in most cases, people will allow that to be dictated by the modern day. Does not have your best interests at heart. So to be aware of those things and to start building a brain so that you start making better decisions tomorrow, that is the key. Yesterday's decisions were dictated by the brain that was built long before that. And we can't, as a society, continue to live from this reactive state. We have to be proactive. We have to be reflective. And we have to, I think, use COVID as an example of what happens when we're not prepared, when, you know, vaccinations, masking, all these things are just an attempt to, in essence, band-aid what was a pre-existing problem, which was poor health. And yes, they're effective for this, but COVID-19 will hopefully be over sometime soon, and then it'll be the next thing. And if it isn't a virus, it'll just be the chronic metabolic diseases that have already existed. So I think, you know, again, if listeners take home one thing, it's unless you start designing your future brain, you are going to allow your choices and your health to be directed by the modern world. And that hasn't worked out for the majority of people, and you can't expect that's going to work out for you.
Well said. And Austin, I just want to thank you because I feel like you've been pretty consistent about talking about this since the beginning. And it even embraces a lot of themes that you wrote about inside of your book, Brainwash. It's like the book became even more relevant during the pandemic and everything that we went through that was there. So I want to acknowledge you for that. You have a new podcast. I want to give it a little bit of love so that people can check it out. And maybe you have a couple episodes that, based on this conversation here, would be a next, you know, good listen for people. So what's the name of the podcast and any episodes that might be good for us to link to that could be a natural continuation of this conversation or at least some of the themes that were in there?
Yeah. So the podcast is called Get the Stuck Out, STUCK, and it's available on Apple and Spotify. And the theme of this podcast is a lot of what we've just been discussing, which is, I believe that we as modern day humans are stuck, and that stuckness happens in the brain, it happens in the body, and that by understanding the causes of that stuckness, the systems involved in that stuckness, whether it's the immune system or our psychology, then we're able to get the stuck out. And I've, you know, had the opportunity to interview a pretty decent range of people so far. I think one that stands out is a recent one I did with Dean and Aisha Shirzai. They are a couple of neurologists out of Loma Linda. And then the other one would be with Dr. Dimitrios Sotiris. And so in the episode with Dr. Sotiris, he is a psychiatrist who specializes in anxiety. We really just talk about, what is anxiety? What are some of the fundamental definitions of anxiety? And what can we do to start reprogramming brains away from that? But there are a host of characters that I know you are very familiar with. We have our mutual friend, Dr. Casey Means on there. And then again, another group of people that I know that you know as well. But I think that if people want to do the deep dive right off the bat, the first several episodes are just me kind of doing a monologue, talking about some of the themes that, again, we discussed today. So if you're interested in hearing about food, the brain, and stuckness, that would be the episode with the Scherzeis. And if you're interested in anxiety, the brain, and stuckness, Dr. Demetrios Sotiris. And if you're interested in hearing me ramble on about some of these themes, check out some of the early episodes.
Awesome. We'll have links to them all. Austin, a pleasure. And always fun to chat with you because I feel like you are thinking about a lot of subjects that everybody is also thinking about, but you have a way of connecting the dots and zooming out and zooming in to really help us take away practical tips, but also understand the context of which they sit in. So I want to acknowledge you for really just being good at communicating that zooming in and zooming out, which is not always easy to do.
Very kind, Drew, and right back at you. As we discussed before this interview, I think that as much information as there is out there in the world, it's kind of rare to find ways that it's communicated in a balanced way and in a way that actually leads to benefit to the user. And I think that you and the work you've done in your podcast, obviously, are really great modalities in making these more technical ideas and often more polarized ideas into something that is balanced and going to translate into benefit in people's lives.
Thank you, my friend. Well, Dr. Austin Perlmutter, until next time, I appreciate you, brother.